You're listening to The Stack, first broadcast on the 10th of November, 2012, on Monocle 24. The Stack, in association with J.Crew.
An autumn walk down a boulevard full of magazines in Tokyo, a pair of printmen get a bit of ink on their fingers, and a bit of chat about royalties from search engines. All that ahead on edition 11 of The Stack. Also coming up on the program, a conversation with the Russian billionaire and publishing magnate, Alexander Lebedev.
We have grown up as a society for being responsible for what's about to be produced around us. Or we will be just paternalistic and just all phrasing the authorities and having no opposition, no free media, no independent judiciary, no independent parliament, no proper election, and say, okay, it's fine. Why do we need that? I mean, it's very simple to find out the truth.
Plus, we find out what's jumping off the shelves at Notting Hill's best magazine shop.
Fashion, media, and design magazines. There's a lot of various people here in this area who are in those industries. So we have a number of people who come in and buy 10 or 20 different magazines.
That was from Rococo. All that and a few reading tips from Down Under, live from Studio One here at Midori House on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 11 of The Stack here on Monocle 24. I'm Tyler Brulé. This time, last weekend, Sunday morning to be exact, I was wandering down one of my favourite streets in the world, Magazine Avenue at Tsutaya Books in Tokyo's Daikanyama neighbourhood. In between scores of chic and funkily dressed browsers, I spent a good chunk of the day discovering British titles hard to find in London, tiny titles from the Pacific Northwest seldom seen on shelves in Seattle, and plenty of other great pieces of print from Korea, Singapore, Canada, Germany, and Sweden. If you haven't been to this little piece of media heaven, go. If you can't jump on a flight, then you can always go and see our film on our website. While Tsutaya Books is a great patch of retail, it's also a shining example of how a large-scale retailer can create an environment where people can linger or seriously spend on a global, eclectic collection of vintage auto repair manuals, new interior books from Gestalten, vinyl found at yard sales in the US Midwest, and all the magazines you could ever want for a lifetime of rainy Sundays. As major chains gear up for Christmas and we're about to be told about the challenging environment for bricks-and-mortar stores, big book retailers from Europe, Australia, and North America might want to head to Japan before giving up the game. And now, taking it back to rainy London, our guests around the table here in Studio One today. Well, our first guest started out writing for The Stage. He now edits Time Out's flagship magazine here in London, which recently overhauled its business model by going free. Tim, Arthur, welcome.
Good morning.
We could probably spend a whole program on this very topic. The first thing I want to ask, though, is when you made this announcement, how did the rest of your franchisees or partners around the world take this? I mean, is this something that you think everyone's going to follow? Because, of course, there are so many timeouts around the world, but mm-hmm. You are the mothership.
Yeah. There was some concern when we first announced it, but we didn't kind of announce it. We discussed it with them, so they were fully aware of the process. But the thing for us is London has a very specific free market that's really established, mm-hmm. and very few other cities around the world have. So it's not really, it wasn't designed as this is now the future of all timeouts around the world. They will all go free. London was a particular test case, and so far, touch wood, it's gone really well. Their main concern actually was that their associations with free magazines haven't been that great. Mm. You know, would we dumb down the content? Would it change fundamentally? It wouldn't be the magazine that they thought it was going to be. And so we did a lot of work really with them before we went free, just saying, right, this is the format we're looking at. We're not changing the writers. We're not changing the style of editorial or content. We're just going free, effectively. Mm.
And for people beyond London, what is the distribution model now?
The distribution model now is that we come out on the Tuesday, like we used to, but it's about 180,000 copies are given out at train stations and outside tubes on Tuesday morning, and then another 150,000 or so are given out in cultural institutions. They're there throughout the week. So cultural institutions, still in a lot of news agents, actually. A lot of news agents who had taken the magazine out have now put it back in because they like people coming into the shop just to pick up their time out because they then buy some chewing gum.
So just sitting there at the cash.
And they get that for free, but they pick other stuff up. So
right.
So hopefully it's all over town. That's the main the main feeling.
Excellent. Well, our next guest, Davy Spens, you may not recognize his name, but you've certainly heard about his title many times around this very table here in Studio One. He's a creative director of Boat Magazine, which focuses on a different, sometimes complicated city, every single issue. I'm always quite jealous about, again, we talk about business models. How do you pull this together? Because it's one thing whenever we've been chatting to guests here, they wonder, you know, do you literally have a barge that you pull up at somewhere along the shoreline and then deploy a team of writers and photographers? How does it work?
So we started Boat Magazine a couple of years ago. It started as a design studio, and we had a quiet patch in the year. So we picked up the studio and flew it to Sarajevo. We rented a house and we invited photographers and writers out. And we came back with the first issue of Sarajevo, of Boat Magazine. And the whole thought of it is there's lots of cities around the world that are in the media, in the news. And as cuts to journalism kind of seem to continue, there's lots of places that aren't really done justice.
Mm.
So we go to places with the intention of getting lost in a city and soaking it up and then and spitting it out in the pages of a magazine. So we rent a house and we invite our favourite people out there with us and we tell some stories. And so it comes out biannually. I'm not sure we could sustain it any more than that because it's an expensive thing that we do. But it's a kind of passion project and it's about juggling the kind of commercial side of it with the creativity and the things that are important to us.
This issue number three, looks at London and indeed a city which, of course, has its triumphs and challenges. But when you look at the cover line, an antidote to lazy journalism. I wonder just about the commissioning process. Great that everyone sort of, treks off to a city and everyone is obviously sort of, collected and gathered around and dissecting things. But, how long is the process then, to actually say, look, we're going to set a deadline, or is it quite fluid the way this develops every issue?
You can be
honest here if you want.
No. It's quite fixed, actually. We just come back from Athens. The Athens issue goes to print on Monday and we'll be out at the end of the month. We have a 2-week window in each city. We book a house, we invite people, they fly out and we have about 6 weeks to pull the content together when we get back to London. So it's quite a tight process, but we try and treat it as a blank canvas. There's not a particularly strong editorial stance as a magazine apart from really trying to do a city justice.
Mm.
And then antidote to lazy journalism is as much an ambition, really, as a claim.
Well, you need something to keep you honest, month in and month out. Now, just as Tim was announcing a little bit earlier and just talking about the role that news agents play, well, every once in a while here on the program, we like to head to a magazine store, which causes a bit of buzz, even if it's just in its own neighborhood. Earlier this week, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, met the owner of Rococo. People who live on the west side of London will know it very well, Mr. Ketan and Patel runs the show there. Rococo is located in leafy Notting Hill. They stock over 3,000 titles. Ketan told Fernando about his best-selling titles and his unwavering belief in print.
I'm Ketan Patel. I'm part of the board of directors of a company called Shivam Capital Limited. We basically own the Rococo News and Magazine shop in Notting Hill. We also have a sister shop in Herne Hill. Basically, we've been running this shop for the last 5 years. We have got a lot of experience in newsagents, so all the directors have pretty much over 60 to 70 plus years of experience running newsagents. We have a lot of experience specifically in the magazine side of things. And that's the section, considering the falling sort of newspaper subscriptions and things like that, that's the part of the shop that we are trying to focus on a lot, basically.
Can you describe the shop? What's the size?
Yeah, it's sort of a fairly large shop. It's about 1,000 square feet plus. We have it arranged over two floors, so the underground cellars house our offices and all our stock. Upstairs, we have pretty much, I would say, 60 to 70% of the shop dedicated purely to magazines. We also sell an absolutely comprehensive array of not just magazines, but also international and national newspapers, a number of European languages, Spanish, German, Italian magazines we sell. We sell newspapers, again, Spanish, German, Italian. We sell sort of Mediterranean newspapers as well. There's a lot of magazines you will not see anywhere. For example, even like cars. Because London is such a cosmopolitan city, we want to try and cater to as many different kinds of people as possible, really.
What makes your shop different from other news agents?
Very simply, I think two things. One is the comprehensive nature of our offering. We basically stock 3,000 titles, full stop. There is very few shops who will sell 3,000 different magazines. For example, I can give you one example is one of my colleagues wanted to get a tattoo magazine. I said to him to come around to the shop. He came around. He was quite amazed that we actually sell 11 different types of tattoo magazines. If you look at our front display, which sells only very specifically fashion and media magazines, we have close to 100 plus titles of almost all the top fashion and media titles that you can find anywhere else. There's probably very few shops in London, maybe one or two more, who would probably actually sell such a comprehensive selections. For example, Condé Nast, we have absolutely every single title that they sell. All of them. So if you go to Condé Nast demo shop, we probably have a higher selection of magazines than theirs, for example. We also have magazines in every different category. So sports, men's lifestyle, women's lifestyle, home and furnishings, children's magazines, all different sort of case, music, media, fashion, design, art, architecture. Anybody who comes over, and a lot of people and a lot of customers have come over and said our selection is pretty much the best they have seen anywhere else in London, for example.
And what are your main sellers?
The main sellers, obviously, because we are based in Notting Hill, it's fashion, media and design magazines. There's a lot of various people here in this area who are in those industries. So we have a number of people who come in and buy pretty much, say, 10 or 20 different magazines of all different types. So they'll probably buy a number of Vogue magazines, number of other fashion titles. And then obviously they are using that for their own sort of getting a shade on where the market is, for example. So I would say fashion, media, current affairs, obviously, and design magazines, art, architecture, and design magazines. We sell a lot of those. Music as well, we have a comprehensive selection.
Are you a firm believer in print media?
I certainly am a firm believer in print media. Very simply, it's magazine is often synonymous with a bit of relaxation as well. So it's very easy to pick up a print media and read up and have a, you know, quiet time in a corner. It's not the same thing with, for example, an iPad. There are certain advantages iPad offers over analog media effectively. But then I would say, at the moment, the sort of generation we have, and maybe the newer generation will probably switch over to iPad and so on and so forth. But I still think, as long as it's very well presented and it's not commoditized, there is definitely a lot of demand for print media, effectively.
And that was Ketan Patel, owner of Rococo in Notting Hill here in London. He was talking to our Fernando Augusto Pacheco. I have to ask both of you gentlemen, and I'll start with you, Jim, where do you pick up your magazines? Is it just somewhere on top of a stack of filing cabinets in the Time Out office, or are you still able to sort of venture out and really have your own sort of private bundle that you pick up somewhere, or are you a subscriber?
Yeah, I'm not a subscriber. And since we've gone free, actually, I used to just pick them up at the office. Since I've got free, I would get really excited about just seeing it being given out on the street. So a lot of the time on Tuesday morning, I come into Charing Cross, so I pick one up there, pick up a couple at Tottenham Court Road on the way. You know, it's just lovely to see the magazine out and about, actually. So I pick it up quite a lot of places. Also, it's nice to see the experience of what it's like, what everyone else is doing when they're picking it up, who's picking it up.
Right.
You know.
And what about the rest of your diet, though, when it comes to all the other things you want to read? Is it, fighting with people in the office for the copies that come in there, or do you actually... maybe not in the morning like right now in London. Yeah. On a sunny Saturday, do you like to go down to your newsagent, or would you prefer to have them drop through the letterbox?
I have them drop through the letterbox, mainly. I'm mainly a subscriber man. Or I have my mother-in-law who subscribes to a couple of mags, and then I just wait for her to finish with them, and I pick up that one off her.
That's fair enough as well. Davey?
Well, I'm sort of interested in the titles that fall through the gaps. So in the mainstream newsagent, for example,
Boat Magazine. They're not
going to be there. No, in WH Smith, they put us in the boat section. So
that's fine. You know, we're in the cycling section because most people think that the magazine actually is called Monocycle. I'm not. I kid you not.
So I have there's a list in London of shops that I'll drop in on. Charlotte Street News is a great example. Magma in Covent Garden, and just trying to kind of find the titles that are challenging the status quo and doing something a bit different, and often struggling. Yeah.
Yeah, and when you talk about things that fall through the cracks, so what do you like at the moment? And I know you've got some things there that we're going to look at, but why do we keep everyone in suspense? But aside from those, what do you like at the moment?
Well, I import quite a few magazines. There's a magazine called Afar from America. It's a travel magazine for people like me. I wouldn't necessarily think it falls through the cracks, but it's not around here. It's not available here. But it sort of takes a generation who don't need to be told what hotel to go to, but they do need to know what neighbourhood to go to.
Right.
And it's just that's an interesting one. This Off-Screen magazine, which is a great magazine. We're lucky enough to get sent magazines as well from people, so we have a constant supply coming through our letterbox.
Excellent. We're going to go away for a very short break. When we come back, we're going to have a very brief interview with Alexander Lebedev. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Back in a moment.
J.Crew's designers are constantly pushing boundaries with hopes of making the best clothing available today. As head menswear designer Frank Malchin says, every garment J.Crew produces requires attention to detail, meaning the little things are as important as the most obvious.
We don't leave a stone unturned, like every detail is important to us. Every component of a garment gets a lot of attention, different button shapes, everything, like even stitches per inch is important to us, you know, like, and for an outsider it might not look like something, but even the stitch color is important. Like all those little things people sometimes take for granted, and people maybe don't realize that there's a thought process behind that as well.
J. Crew.
The power of photography was pulled into focus at this year's Pre-Pic Day, the world's leading prize for photography in the realm of sustainability.
These are true artists, and they have incredible integrity. I mean, they tell you how it is. In the process, it's often disturbing. Sometimes it's beautiful in an abstract way, but it really touches a nerve.
Monocle Films attended the awards, and you can watch our film in the programs menu on monocle.com.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24, where we are joined by Tim Arthur from Time Out here in London, Davy Spence of Boat Magazine. Now, I talked about Alexander Lebedev. He is coming up on the program, and no, we're not waiting for him. It's a pre-recorded piece that we have. But I thought we would start with, Dave, I'll start with you. I see that you have a copy of Inventory magazine from Vancouver there. As I said, I was just in Japan last week, and it's extraordinary, the distribution and how that title does, particularly in that market. And the one you've got there has got Nigo on the cover. And yeah, why did you choose Inventory?
I love this magazine. I love the way that it celebrates the ideas and the people behind design and culture. And not just focus on the kind of product itself. It's about stories. I actually bought this one last week and devoured it from cover to cover. And
you've marked about 56 pages in there. So
there was one thing that really struck me. It was from the director's note at the beginning, and he says, since the beginning, Inventory has been a learning experience, but this year has proved to be as much of a test on the personal side as on the business side. And he goes on to talk about the challenges of running a magazine. And there was just one line in it which struck me. It was, keeping the balance between financial stability and creativity is not a particularly easy task, but it's essential to us. And there's something about the spirit of this magazine and the spirit of the magazines that I'm drawn to that juggle those two things. And interestingly, within this issue, there's an interview with the managing director of Vitsu, and his amazing story about his personal passion for furniture and furniture design. and the lengths that he went to juggle both of those things.
Yeah, and stay true to it, and the fact that they're still, you know, manufacturing, well, here on these shores in the UK, that they could have very easily gone and done their aluminium pulls, you know, in any number of markets where lots of other aluminium things are being built, and then they stick to it, and people have to pay, you know, people have to pay the price, and they're not going to swerve on that.
No.
Did it also resonate, though, just given where you are in the lifespan of your magazine as well?
Absolutely. I mean, it's a constant. How do you grow? What concessions are you making to do things? And I suppose that's why all three of the magazines I brought in are navigating that course in a different way.
Yeah.
I suppose there was a second article in here that I thought which particularly resonated, and it's about Red Wing shoes in Japan and how they kind of bought the company back because they wanted to bring it back from its. Bring it back to its American heritage, and it was again the same thing about creativity and staying true versus the kind of commercial desires of expansion.
Mm. Do you think that's the direction that we're moving in right now? And even a little bit earlier, when we heard that piece with Mr. Patel from Rococo, he talked about its design, its fashion, its magazines that are in that territory that are continuing to do well, and, you know, maybe sort of other things are falling off along the wayside. So do you think it's titles like that that are going to be able to hopefully negotiate that balance in a positive sense, still deliver fresh, interesting stories, you know, still obviously they'll have to, you know, strike up commercial relationships, you know, with advertisers to sustain themselves or charge a high enough, you know, cover price? Or do you think it's wide open for everyone? I mean, you know, beautifully designed magazine, but, you know, you're not in, you know, the style or design territory necessarily, though, because also you're tackling, you know, much grittier subjects as well.
That's a constant balance with us, and we know that our audience is quite broad, and the design community like us, but our content is broad journalism in many senses. So it's trying to stay true to the reason why we started in the first place. But there's lots of commercial pressures, and advertising is very difficult for a magazine that's as broad and unusual as ours, I suppose.
Mm. Do you think with Time Out that, you know, and as you said, I mean, London is quite unique because this isn't just a market where we have, you know, the traditional sort of free daily papers that have done well, but, you know, there are some weeklies that have been doing some interesting things, some other free titles which have come onto the market, you know, as well, that might even be sort of picking up where you guys left off. Is this going to, you know, are we going to be in a world of £20 magazines on one side, and then, you know, maybe there'll be sort of the supermarket weeklies, etc., but then sort of this world of free, and it will continue to be a very challenging times for the likes of, you know, Newsweek, which is, you know, we've been talking about it the last few weeks, which was, you know, is about to go out of print, and many others probably in that territory.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, to be honest, yes. I mean, I think that is the case. I think that one of the successful models is the large niche. I was talking before we came on, actually, about the great thing for a niche magazine now is it has, because of the internet, because social networking, it can have a global reach. You can find 500 people in enough cities around the world, and, you know, you only need that to actually build up a model which is sustainable, and it's a sort of, you found your market.
Mm.
For a large magazine to really continue to be successful, you've got to break through that idea that a lot of people just don't want to buy magazines. They don't want to spend money unless they're really, really passionate and they're going to go, OK, I'll tell you what, I'll pay £10 for that because it's a work of art, it's beautiful.
And because it's hitting their particular
passion
point.
It's hitting their sweet spot. It's really in the sweet spot, yeah. I've got a 17-year-old daughter, and the concept of her actually buying a magazine, she just is totally alien to her. All her information is free. Everything she does, you know, she watches. Now she doesn't even buy music. She watches music on YouTube, and that's her playlist, or, you know, Spotify at best.
Mm.
But if there's one thing she was absolutely passionate about and wouldn't not miss, then she'd pay the money for that. But
has she found that title yet? I'm sure lots of, you know, publishers are listening and sort of wondering, you know, what is that you know, niche for that segment?
At the moment, unless there's a really good goth vampire one out there just for twihards, I doubt it.
No, right.
I mean, mainly, she was very nicely for me. She reads the magazines that I bring home. So, she reads Time Out, she reads Juxtapose, the kind of art thing. She's quite eclectic in her taste for a 17-year-old, but it has to come to her. She's not very good at actually going out and finding print.
Do you think that this represents, and this is to both of you, but do you think this represents a certain moment in time in the media landscape? Because you know, and I want to talk about, you know, all of the discussion that we've had, you know, with, you know, the Brazilians, the Germans, you know, what's going to happen with royalties, you know, via Google, etc. That we're reaching a bit of a turning point right now, that the culture of free, you know, and I think certainly, as you say on the cover of the magazine, Dave, you know, an antidote to lazy journalism. Journalism, lazy or otherwise, costs money.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. But for me, the thing is, it'll be quality that will out anyway. The interesting thing with the free market is the free market doesn't always work. It's not a given that you go, okay, we'll go free, you'll get a huge circulation, advertising will come in, that'll support it, and off you go. It's actually really only the quality, you know, the best quality ones who really know their audience. I think for us, I'm quite inspired by Stylist, which is the London free, you know, because actually Lisa, who edits that, knows her audience really well. She speaks very directly to a very large audience.
Yeah, and just
makes it work.
And for everyone's consumption, Stylist comes out end of the week, I believe.
Comes out, yeah.
Yeah, and it is it's stapled. It's but on newsprint, it feels sort of like a traditional London tabloid. It sort of feels like some of the supplements that used to be in the Evening Standard, etc. And then there's some other siblings in the stable as well.
Yeah, there's Shortlist, which is those two are kind of separated into a men's magazine and a women's magazine.
Right.
And for us, we're a Londoners magazine, so we thought that's why there was a place in our market for us. We talk about London. We're not gender specific. It's just people who want to go out and have a good time and want to discover stuff in London. So for us, that's a massive market. So,
I mean, David, you talk about something which is radically different. You have a very confident £8 cover price. And I'm wondering two things. 17-year-olds, are teenagers finding this? Because, you know, I would say what's interesting, just, you know, with the Monocle exercise, is that I almost think there's a post magazine generation out there as well, who have been weaned on this diet of, you know, digital everything, and maybe even grew up in households which weren't even, you know, very, you know, necessarily fond of magazines. And now, you know, we have events, you meet people, oh, you know, I'm absolutely passionate about this, because it's tactile and, you know, all of the good things we know that the great print does. So just back to my earlier question, do you think that this represents a moment in time and there is going to be almost a re-education about the value equation of getting this, you know, title like Vogue into your hands?
I think so, because I think there's a lot of magazines out there that are just creating content that you can find anywhere else on the internet, and people will naturally go to the web for some of the stories and content to get it quicker and to get it now and to get it delivered to them without them having to go looking for it. And as such, there'll be a lot of titles out there that simply won't survive because they can't compete with that. But equally, there are the magazines I'm drawn to are kind of statements of passion, and they're passionate pieces from start to finish, and they deliver content that is considered and thoughtful that you can't get in other places. And so I think it's really about quality, and the longevity of beautiful ideas.
Mm. I'm curious to find out at that cover price, and Tim, you know, as you were saying, you know, what's great about sort of, you know, the world and being so connected is that, you know, people can find, you know, they can find out something, you know, you can suddenly sort of build a model on scores of people in one market, you know, hopefully if they buy it. So is there a global traditional newsstand distribution model behind this, or are there a lot of people licking stamps and throwing things into jiffy bags in your office and dispatching them around the world?
About 60% of our copies are sold through our website. Because it's a biannual magazine, we do not have vast numbers of subscribers because they're getting two issues a year. So we treat every issue as an event. Because it's a different city, it's kind of easy to. And the great thing about our magazine is the very next question after reading one is, where next?
Right.
So it's quite easy to then build a story about the next place. And so we use social networking a lot. It's great because people can find niche titles now. And I suppose that's one of the amazing things about the internet is people hunting out niche titles and finding the things they're passionate about and that reflect and resonate with them. Mm. So yeah, our model is, we didn't start with a business model. We are developing one as we go along. But we're distributed in America and Australia and the UK.
Right.
So we are on newsstands, but more the Rococos of this world than...
Sure. So there's not a massive plan behind the £8. It's just that it's a figure that looks nice on the cover.
No, we in all honesty, we struggled to attract advertisers initially, £8 covers the costs of printing the magazine, and We have a design studio. That's the main thing of the main thrust of what we do. And the magazine is something that's developing and growing issue on issue. And I suppose why I resonated with the letter at the start of inventory is that thing of juggling creativity and passion and ideas with commerce.
To both of you, and Tim, we'll start with you, because I think a lot of people, you know, some people argued that it was very, you know, that the approach that Time Out had, was quite interesting, very much a gamble early on, that it didn't follow, let's say, the path that maybe New York Magazine has gone down in the United States, mm-hmm. where, you know, New York, you know, still has, you know, a comprehensive, you know, listing side to the magazine. It also has a very, you know, big, quite newsy, dynamic website as well. And then many said, well, you know, Time Out is not going to venture down, you know, being this all-sing, all-dancing listing site, at least in the early days. It's going to sort of stick to what it does in print. And I'm wondering, you know, now you have gone free, you know, is it a case that you feel that it's sheer numbers of eyeballs, or is it also the quality of who those people are as well? Because I think that's a raging debate in lots of media buying agencies. You know, going back to David's point about, you know, about magazines, you have a lot of people, I would say, from the post magazine generation who maybe haven't even discovered print, mm-hmm. who think, well, everything has to be digital, and it's purely volume rather than quality.
Yeah, I mean, for me, Time Out has a specific purpose, and that is to make people go out and make the most of any city that we're in. So if it's London, we think it's the best city in the world, and we want people to discover new bits about it. But I'm not really interested in readers just reading it because it's a nice read. I want them to go and do stuff. And so our readers who pick it up, that's the vibe they get. The lovely thing about going free, suddenly with this reach, you actually get to see the impact. I think in our very first issue, we had there's a great slider restaurant called Lucky Chip that just opened. We put it as our restaurant of the week, and they sold out all their food in the restaurant for a week. And just to know that actually not only do people read the magazine, but they then act on it and go and do stuff is fantastic. Then everyone's happy. And for our editorial team as well, it's a fantastic buzz around the office at the moment, because people are going, wow, not only are we writing stuff that we are passionate about, care about, but other people are now going and acting on it, you know, in large numbers. So it's an exciting time.
Has that shifted the behavior between what happens then, you know, given that you're free now versus then what happens from an online capacity? Does it take some of the heat away from the website because you're actually able to just get this into lots of people's hands?
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, in fact, what's happened is been an incredible uplift on our website as well. It's had a beneficial effect. I mean, that was part of the business model right from the start.
Okay.
Whereas, you know, we are a multimedia company. Our website, just before we went free, had about 4 million uniques on the website each month, which is quite healthy for a city-based, you know, single city-based thing.
Yeah.
6 weeks down the line, that unique number's gone up to 5.2 million. And looks like it'll be 7.2 million by Christmas. So it's having this incredible effect that we really wanted as well, which was sending people, you know, the magazine, the new magazine, the free magazine, is designed to just filter out stuff. It literally is, this is the best of London this week. But if you want to know everything that's in London, you go to our website. If you want to know what's nearest you, you go to the app. It's just like many companies, it's a, you know, a model right across every platform. But for me, that was one of the things of designing this magazine now. It wasn't designing a magazine from scratch that was just a standalone product. For me, that is part of a portfolio of stuff we do. And actually, for me, it was the challenge of making sure that our writers felt comfortable with this as a product and all our online stuff.
Davey, how do you reconcile with your title, you know, what is free when you've got an £8 cover price? Or maybe I should ask you directly, what is your web strategy?
Our web strategy, well, we launched a website to sell magazines to start with. We had no web content strategy. We have subsequently, we create two or three stories a week, which keep our audience engaged. And I think when people pay £8 to buy a magazine, you know you've got an audience that actively wants the stuff that you make, rather than, I suppose this is my thing about free, getting it into someone's hands is very different from people being engaged. Time Out's a very engaging and very engaging magazine, so I'm not talking about Time
Out. It's okay, you can duke it out all you want, it's fine.
But I think when someone's prepared to pay £8 to buy a magazine and there's enough of them, you've got the most engaged audience. And so our web strategy is really to keep delivering content between the issues, because 6 months is a long period of time to not have a new issue of Boat magazine in your hands.
So what would happen then, you know, of a week when you bring out new stories? Are these offcuts of maybe some things that didn't make it? Are you following the theme of those cities? Are you foreshadowing and using it as a promotion thing for what's coming up in Athens? How does it work?
Well, the new issue, when it comes out, has a new strapline, which is travel to the heart of a city. And it's really about an audience of 20 to 35-year-old urban travellers who love travel, who go to the cities that aren't the New Yorks and Parises and Tokyos of this world, because they're more interested in those of this new world of cities, the less discovered cities. And so we're trying to find stories and interesting people and ideas from places that you may not know so much about. But also, we have a few regular features. One is called Up My Street, and it looks at a neighbourhood in a place, because we all want to go to Paris. We know how to find a cheap flight. We know how to find a hotel. But what neighbourhood should I be in?
Mm.
It's that kind of... We're trying to serve up travel in a way that a lot of travel publications aren't. To a smart audience who are engaged, you know what they're doing, but just give them a bit more of the spirit or the soul of a place and tell them what neighbourhoods to be, and don't try and spoon-feed them the rest of it.
Sounds like a good ad pitch to me. We're going to take a short break. You're listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Back in a moment.
The designers at J. Crew are constantly experimenting with new styles, but it's their staples that they're most proud of. As head menswear designer Frank Mauchens explains, J. Crew's unique approach to tailored clothing led to the now iconic Ludlow suit, recognized for its superior construction and smart bespoke details.
I love it when people start to recognize garments by the way they are cut. It gives it its own personality, and I think that's what we're looking for. And for instance, the Ludlow jacket has a specific narrow lapel. It's narrow, but not too narrow. It has a really nice soft shoulder. It has a shoulder pad in it, but just ever so subtly. And I think the Ludlow jacket is so great. I think there's about 200 steps it takes to make a Ludlow jacket. People maybe sometimes don't realize what it takes to come to this kind of product.
J. Crew.
Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
And you're back with The Stack here on Monocle 24. Well, Alexander Lebedev is best known in the UK as the owner of The Independent and Evening Standard newspapers, but they were not his first titles. Back home in Russia, he's the publisher of Novaya Gazeta. The newspaper is a feisty, independent voice on Russia's mostly muted media landscape, and its criticism of officials at all levels has often made it a target, sometimes tragically. Several of its staff have been murdered, most famously fierce Kremlin critic Anna Politkovskaya in 2006. Lebedev has financed the paper with profits from his business interests, including agriculture, airlines, and banking. But since last year, he has come under serious pressure. There were raids on his bank, and then a scuffle with another businessman during the taping of a TV program that led to a criminal investigation, a ban on leaving the country, and a possible jail sentence, and I'm not sure how many YouTube views as well. Our Peter Van Dyke sat down with Mr. Lebedev recently and asked him what it's like owning a newspaper in Russia.
I've been the publisher of Novaya Gazeta for 7 years. And you could hardly find bureaucracy in this country who have not been investigated. Now, all the bureaucrats normally think it's the publisher who's responsible, where in reality I open up the paper together with all of them. And as a matter of principle, I'm not influencing the journalists. So we disagree in the paper quite a lot, and I wouldn't say that I support every journalism. It consists of people, and people are people, I mean, with various views. And but for the bureaucracy, it's still the same. They hate me. And of course, that influences my business.
Do you feel like you're being made an example of because of your oppositional activity? And do you think there are other wealthy Russians who perhaps have a certain level of support or sympathy for, if not the opposition protests or things like that, more liberal ideas, who would be reluctant because of the danger to their business and their wealth to actually get involved to the level that you've got involved?
Hmm. Well, the good thing, they might be people like that, but the sad one is that they're not demonstrating it in any way. So they might be just in internal moral exile inside themselves. Not that I've noticed anybody approaching with a penny to support Nova Gazeta. So we're facing a very precarious future. I don't think I'll be able to support it anymore. So probably within a couple of months' time, we'll be facing the reality, which is it has been like about $3 million a year, not that much money. And what we're going to do probably will be trying to follow the National Public Radio example, which is going out to the public and say, that, guys, if you need us, if you really think we're sort of compensating public opinion in a sense, and you like what we're doing, sometimes it's very sad to read what we write about. It makes you pessimistic, like Chekhov. But I mean, somebody has to do that. Because as Gogol once said, I mean, you first have to really unravel some very dirty part of the public life to really show something which is good.
Do you feel sad for Russia in a way that you are a lone, not voice, but almost a lone businessman making this public effort where anyone else with means similar to you are all towing the Kremlin line, as it were?
Well, whether I'm sad or well, I just am ready to face the facts with whatever feeling I've got. It's not very important. The important is whether we have grown up as a society for being responsible for what's about to be produced around us, or we will be just paternalistic and just all phrasing the authorities and having no opposition, no free media, no independent judiciary, no independent parliament, no proper election, and say, okay, it's fine. Why do we need that? Whether it's said or not, I don't know. But, I mean, it's very simple to find out the truth. If Novaya Gazeta does not survive, and if the opposition does not survive, or survive within a very small, limited gulag, hopefully not gulag, it's probably, I mean, it's subconsciousness speaks in me, inside a reservation, then it doesn't work.
Novaya Gazeta is obviously very important to you. You have...
Hopefully not only to me.
Yes. How happy are you with the way things are going with the Independent and the Evening Standard, your UK newspapers?
Well, Standard has been turned out from £30 million, which is, what, about 40-something million US dollar loss to a small profit this year. The Indy is doing, according to the plan, but we still need additional infusion of cash over a couple of years, because it's not easy to turn it from a big loss into a profit. The Eye is doing fine. It's probably the biggest example of a new paper printed, launched successfully into the market. It was under 300,000 copies a day. So it has been an interesting experience.
Newspapers obviously play a very big role in a society. How does owning a newspaper in a foreign country change your relationship with that country?
Well, it's nice to become part of the culture. The British journalism, the same as the British literature, or great architects, or great painters. Well, I mean, we all have some vanity, and when you can feel there's a society, there's a sense of gratitude at every level. And, I mean, you can get it from a taxi cab driver, or for a porter in the hotel, or somebody in the government, somebody in the parliament. It's nice. And it's unfortunately, it's very different from what you get here. Here you either get ignorance because they don't read Nova Gazeta. Some people would come and say thanks. That's true. And the bureaucracy would hate you because they don't still think that it has to be like that. Somebody has to do that. It's about them. It's about their families. It's about the future of the country. But each of them think, oh, because we do a lot of things under the carpet, under the table, in the dark corner, if Nova Gazeta doesn't exist, then nobody would catch us red-handed.
You sound very frustrated. Would your frustration ever lead you to leave Russia?
And doing what? Well, only
you have enough money to be able to live anywhere in the world.
I'm not the kind of a person to spend my time idling on a boat in the south of France. I could have acquired that. Instead of that, I've spent hundreds of millions of producing potato in this country. I'm the biggest producer in Europe. And I'm interested in it because it kind of fills my life with a sense of accomplishment, say it's Nova Gazeta or Evening Standard or Independent. So I'm afraid then I would feel my life completely wasted.
That was a very candid Alexander Lebedev talking to our Peter Van Dyke in Moscow. And you're still listening to The Stack here on Monocle 24. Of course, you just heard from Alexander Lebedev, known in this country, of course, as the publisher, owner of The Evening Standard and also The Independent and The Independent on Sunday. And of course, I'm also joined by Tim Arthur of Time Out London, Davy Spence from Boat Magazine. Tim, it was interesting. Good news that after losing tens of millions of pounds a year at The Evening Standard, they're making a small profit. Was not so optimistic, though, about The Independent, though, it sounded like.
Yeah, it did, didn't it? It was a remarkably open interview, I thought.
Yeah, I thought. I know it was interesting to listen to. Just when you do your tour, you paint a little picture of you know, getting off at Charing Cross Station and really paying attention to people's you know, consumption habits of print. How much do you think today, in a world of free, do people define themselves? Want to be seen with the brand? Does someone really care to be seen? I mean, there was a statement in the early days about being an independent reader in this country, and you could probably say the same about, you know, in New York, if you're on the subway, you know, what does it mean if you're looking at one of the, you know, three or four, depending on how you look at the titles in New York City as well, what you want to be seen with as well. Does it still matter?
Yeah, I think it does matter. I mean, I think it's interesting. I was listening to Davy about whether or not people pick, you know, when they pick it up, if it's free, are they actually engaging in it deeply? It's fascinating. For things like covers, for instance, for me, looking how quickly people judge the cover is a fascinating thing. They just walk past, go, I'm having that, that's gone.
Right.
But we do know that after a while, you know, you pick it up once, you pick it up twice, if it doesn't resonate with you, if it's not the kind of magazine that you go, yeah, I got what I needed to get out of that, and that might be a totally different amount of time you're with it. You may be, you know, it's a different kind of experience for a free, maybe. But they will not pick it up again. So for us, we still think, hopefully, we always had this thing that Time Out was read by Time Out people. We were writing for the people we knew.
Mm.
And all the feedback that we're getting is they're the same people. They'd actually come with us, a lot more of them come with us on the digital journey. So we had millions on, you know, that were still reading Time Out, but it was all online on the website. Now a lot of them are coming back to the magazine, which is really exciting. But I think things like stylists, I think stylists have got incredible loyalty. They're, you know, they're... people pick it up and they keep it. This, I think, is one of the differences. If you get a magazine right, and touch wood with us so far, you don't see, hopefully, that many left on the tube and stuff. You know you're getting right if people are taking it home and reading it. Mm. If they just pick it up, they flick through it, they go, there's nothing here, and they leave it. You know, you may have done your job for your advertisers,
yeah,
but have you actually done the job that's going to build loyalty, that's going to make people engage and go, oh yeah, I associate myself with Time Out, with a stylist. Mm. Touch wood, that's the big challenge. And it's for us, we're really early stage. We hope that's what we're going to do. But it's very unpredictable when you're looking at the people picking it up. I've given it out twice, put my jacket on and kind of did it to see, and I just could not judge. As the people coming towards me, I would go, oh, that's the kind of Time Out person. Oh no, that's not a Time Out person. Or this person, there's no way they're Time Out. They are Time Out, that's fantastic.
Right.
And actually, it's because Time Out is for Londoners.
Mm.
And you can't second guess them, you know, and you can't go, all right, you're probably one person who goes out a lot and you're probably not. You can't tell how people are by the way they look.
I think there's a whole program to be done about it, what happens with franchises, because, you know, could you say the same thing also about the Time Out reader in Beirut or another market as well, which is interesting, but we're not going to do it on this program because people also want to hear about your own stack that you've brought in today. So I'm going to start with you, Tim. What else do you have? We've only had time for inventory so far.
I will quickly bring up The New Yorker, which is... it is one of my favourite magazines. Mm. And the reason I sort of brought it in is because I am entirely emotionally attached to magazines. And this is one of the things I think is lovely. And actually, I'm emotionally attached to it, not only because I think it is a phenomenal magazine, but because of the way I was introduced to it. When I got married, I got introduced to it by my wife, who she used to get her copy off her father. But my wife died, unfortunately. And there's something now which is absolutely... I have an absolute emotional attachment to The New Yorker because of... being introduced to it by my wife, by losing her. Now when it comes through, it's like a comfort blanket. It's much more to me than just a magazine. And the other thing is because I'm, you know, I came from a writing background, it is a writer's magazine. And what I love is it hasn't gone with the trend, which is matching design to writing. It still stayed incredibly in that realm of, no, you've got, you know, this is a lot of text and you're going to sit there if you want to read it and you're going to take time. And if you don't want to read it, if you're not going to read a 10-page article, it's just not the magazine for you. But I absolutely love it for that. I get totally immersed in it.
I also wanted to just show you this cover as well, which is this week's edition of New York magazine. And I just, there's just such a powerful cover, which is just this, you know, angry sky, absolutely no cover lines. And so the cover line, just very, very small, elegant, the city and the storm starting on page 17. And then just the dateline strap. And you're looking at this view of, and I think just also politically interesting as well, with Lower Manhattan completely in the dark, you know, and then from sort of Midtown upwards, you know, there's this glittering city, and I think that there's power. I think when you see this, that a print moment captured there, no distractions, is really something. But when you get inside the magazine as well, just the depth of coverage of how they've really, you know, completely unearth that story at every single level. I think from photographic reportage to capturing families, to of course, you know, major elements, of course, of infrastructure that also collapse. And it's wonderful seeing. You know, we often talk about the epic image, but that type of epic coverage as well.
It's very interesting working on a magazine that's based in a city, that talks about city life. You know, time out, we're not a political magazine, we're an arts and entertainment magazine.
Right.
But there's certain moments that arrive that you can't not cover. Well, the riots for us last year, I think it came on my fourth edition as editor, and the riots came and they hit midweek when we were just about to put the magazine to bed.
And you can't.
And the cover was going to be street art and then loads of shots of hoodie guys out there tagging the city. And we kind of went, that's not the thing.
You
that
have
can't
to
go
respond.
Out now. You have to respond. So we just got, everyone came in. And then it was a bit like being in a proper magazine. Everyone went, oh, this is good. You know, you get this moment of going, and how do we respond? And what's the right, what's our response to the city? And for us, you know, we're a magazine about who loves the city. So we did, our response was genuinely hurt. It was like, but this is happening to the city we love. How are we going to bounce back?
Yeah. David, we promised our listeners at the top of the program that we're going to talk about some magazines from down under. I see you've got Dapper down there, but you've also got Collect, which I think would be the one that ticks the down under box, I believe. And I've also got Process Journal as well, which certainly for many keen print listeners, is a title from Australia that they might be familiar with as well. But tell us about Collect.
I think Australia's got a really interesting independent magazine culture.
And why is that?
Similar to the UK. I
have my theories. I'm just wondering what yours are.
I don't know whether they place a value on quality and passion in the same way as the kind of London print scene does. Mm. But it feels like the London and Australian print scenes have a real affinity. And we sell a hell of a lot of copies out there. And I just think, I don't know where the appreciation comes from, but we've got a lot of kindred spirits out there. The publisher of Collect, Joshua Fanning, we've been emailing back and forth, and he came over here and we talked about things. What I love about Collect magazine, it's if you don't know it, it's a magazine about neighborhoods, and it's about ideas. It looks at kind of hyper locality, and as Time Out looks at cities in detail, what Collect does is it looks at neighborhoods and communities and the people that live there. And it's something that really resonates with me and with a generation of people who are as interested with the local as they are with the global. And that's what Boat Magazine's about in some ways. It's about, I don't know, there's something that draws me about how we can use the internet as well to connect with hyperlocality in a kind of joined up city way.
Yeah, I think part of it too, when you reference London, is, you know, one side of it is, you know, with Australia, I feel that, you know, when people start things in North America, they want to make it big and corporate, and they have to go and sort of raise lots of money. And I still think there's a startup spirit here, which is very different than Silicon Valley startup. I'm actually I just want to have something to hold on to. And if I do it by the seat of my pants, great. And if it, you know, if it fails, so be it. But there isn't that sort of that big upfront of 3 years of going out and raising capital. Part of my theory. Anyway.
I think there's a culture as well. I mean, in London at the moment, there's a culture of entrepreneurship, of people just get, like the whole pop-up restaurant scene, that whole kind of thing of just people going, you know what, if I want something really high quality, something unique, let's just do it ourselves.
Absolutely.
But who'd have thought that a magazine which is 60% about Adelaide would be as would have a readership globally.
Yeah, and there would be tons of them that you'd see sort of stacked up in Tokyo. Jen, we're going to have to leave it there. Tim Arthur, Time Out London editor and also creative director of Boat Magazine, Davy Spence, thanks very much. Our producers today were Don Trump and Adrian Craddock. Also, I see Katie Bilboa behind the glass. She had to take over the reins today as well. Sam Impey has also been delivering the sound for. If you have any thoughts or comments for this week's show, please drop a line to info@monocle.com. Remember, we're back next Saturday at the very same time. Of course, you can always listen again via monocle.com, iTunes, or also our app. But for now, for all of us here, it is goodbye. Coming up at midday London time, we have Gillian de Bias. She might be joined by Emma Nelson. I'm not sure who's going to be in the seat. But news is up in 1 minute's time. Have a good weekend.